This is your last chance to enter the Ohio Lottery's Fun Turns 50 promotion. Score $3,500 and two tickets to the epic party at the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, where you could win part of another $400,000 in cash prizes. Enter the new 50th anniversary scratch-off or $50 worth of eligible non-winning $5 or $10 scratch-offs and My Lotto rewards through the Ohio Lottery app. Hurry up! The last entry deadline is May 13th. Lottery players are subject to Ohio laws and commission regulations. Play responsibly.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hi, and welcome to New Books in Sports. My name is Keith Rathbone, and I'm coming to you here from Macquarie University. And we're here today speaking with Grant Farid, who teaches at Cornell University. I think it's fair to say he's one of our leading philosophers of sport. His recent books include Martin Heidegger, Save My Life, and In Motion at Rest, The Event of the Athletic Body. But we're here today to talk about his most recent work, The Burden of Overrepresentation, Race, Sport, and Philosophy, from Temple University Press. Thanks for joining us here today, Grant.
Thanks for having me, Mr. Rathbone.
I was hoping that we could start off by having you talk a little bit about how you became a sports philosopher and how you came to this particular project.
I'm not sure I'm a sports philosopher, so let me try and explain what it is I imagine myself to be doing or understand myself to be doing. I've written a fair amount about sport. The first edited collection I did, I think, is 96, and I did this, it's called Rethinking C.L.R. James, and I both edited and contributed an essay, and my essay in there is about James as a political figure who comes to understand politics through sport. James says famously, "Cricket had plunged me into politics long before I was aware of it. When I did turn to politics, I did not have too much to learn." So I spent, much of my career in some ways thinking about sport, sometimes more obviously and in a more sustained fashion. But somewhere, I think, in the last 15 years, especially after I published What's My Name, which, has an extensive chapter on James, and the title of that book, What's My Name, derives from Muhammad Ali's, injunction. And he says, what's my name? What's my name? This sort of intonation. He's fighting Ernie the Octopus Terrell, and Terrell won't call him Muhammad Ali. He keeps calling him Cassius Clay, and Ali's not happy with us. So that book was published in 2003, and I go on to publish, a pamphlet on Yao Ming and race and globalization in the NBA, I think that's something like 2006 or 2007, and then 2007, I'm sure I published a book about being a Liverpool fan called Long Distance Love. And I think at this moment, a certain barrier or limit presents itself to me. That is, I experience a certain frustration. Frustration may be too strong a word, but I can't imagine a better one right now, where I realize that I don't want to write about sport in the way that I have. And somewhere around that time, I'm reading, as I continue to do, a whole lot of Derrida and Heidegger and, you know, folks like Bourdieu and Agamben and so on. And there's a lot of stuff in the event, I mean, go in the philosophical air about the event. And around this time, Ron Artest, who plays for the Indiana Pacers and who is the subject of the first chapter of The Burden of Overrepresentation, goes up into the stands in an NBA game in Indiana. People throw beer on him. He gets suspended for historic number of games, and he's fined a historic amount of money. And that's the moment when things slowly start to come together, or at least they dawn on me, which is that I can no longer write or think sport in the way that I have. You know, as I said, I've reached a certain kind of limit. And so I imagine that I'm going to have to try and produce a new language for how it is I do sport or how it is I think about sport. And that's really what I am trying to do. That's what The Burden of Overrepresentation is all about. It's the meat in the sandwich would be my description. I've written three books on sport and the event. The first one, as you mentioned, is In Motion at Rest, which came out in 2013, and then The Burden of Overrepresentation came out this year, and next year there's a new book from Duke University Press called Entre Nous, Between the World Cup and Me. And all three of these works turn in one way or another on the event. And so what I have tried to do is create a language that can bear the burden of thinking sport philosophically. And that burden is created for me through something like a commitment to, shall we say, philosophy. Because I don't think we can fully grapple with sport unless we treat it philosophically. Now that's, you know, that may be a somewhat hubristic claim. For somebody who spent a lot of time thinking and writing about sport, that's the place I've arrived at. I'm not a philosopher by training, though. I'm not sure who he is, but I have found philosophy, which is to say a certain number of thinkers, are incredibly helpful to assist me to create this language that can bear the weight of thinking sport and enabling us to understand what I think is at stake in sport, and also because I think sport, and perhaps only sport and politics, instantiate the event with such regularity. I think we all watch sport in anticipation of the event, which is to say, you know, you look for that last minute miracle, what Americans call a Hail Mary. Even when your side is down, you think, oh, we can come back. And then sometimes it happens, of course, and this feeds either your pathology or it reinforces your notion of the event, you know. Nobody sees 1917 coming, right? It's there. In retrospect, in its supplementarity, we can understand it's a massive break in history. It's a rupture. And this is what I think sport does. Every time, go ahead, sir.
I was going to say, I think your chapter on François Pinard and Nelson Mandela make this view of the event very clear, because you state that it's Pinard's rejection or negation rather of Mandela that turns this particular moment into an event. So maybe you can tease apart that particular moment for our listeners and illustrate how that becomes an event.
That's true. And in many ways, Artest and the Mandela and Pinard chapter I think those are the signal, that constitutes a chapter. But it's also what I'm, within about 5 or 6 years, I'm thinking about both those things together. But let me talk about the Mandela chapter and the Pinhat chapter. I was invited in 2010 to go back to Duke University, where I had previously taught. And they were doing this seminar on the 2010 World Cup in South Africa, the Football World Cup. And they were doing it something like 4 months before the World Cup began. And I was invited to speak, and they wanted me to talk about football, and I couldn't do it. I thought, no, I've just published this book on, being a Liverpool fan, and it just seemed so sort of predictable, and it's the thing I would have been expected to do. And then, about 15 years earlier, when South Africa is first admitted or readmitted, and I prefer admitted, but there are people who would imagine it as a kind of readmittance, which is to say they transgressed and now they're allowed back. I think post-apartheid South Africa should be disarticulated from its apartheid predecessor. But in any case, I'm invited to give this talk, and I recall this moment when it's a small moment, as you rightly point out, and it should just be pro forma, because South Africa, under somewhat dubious circumstances, has won the 1995 Rugby World Cup. And I remain unconvinced that they beat France, because there are penalties and disallowed tries, and everything feels just a little shady. But in any case, so they beat against all odds, a wonderful, perhaps the greatest all-black team of all time, perhaps the greatest rugby team of all time. Jonah Lomu, Sean Fitzpatrick, and just Glenn Osborne, just a wonderful, wonderful team. And Mandela, as the host president, or to say the host of the presidential host of the host nation, sorry, I phrased that awkwardly, does the pro forma stuff. He hands Francois Pienaar the Afrikaner, the Webb Ellis Trophy, and he says, "Thank you, Francois." And Pienaar, without missing a rhetorical beat, says, "No, thank you, Mr. President." And in that moment, everything turns. Because here you have what Mandela really wants is a moment of national reconciliation. He wants things to come back together. It's a sort of kumbaya moment, right? The new democratic South Africa celebrating this Rugby World Cup, and the black iconic leader meeting, exchanging platitudes with the Afrikaner captain. And the Afrikaner rugby captain is, of course, the very instantiation of, white male Afrikaner dominance. And it's that moment of negation. It's when Pienaar says, "No, thank you, Mr. President." And I'm never quite sure where the emphasis falls. I know it's on one of the second person pronouns, second person singular, that is. And when Mandela is refused, I recognize that what Pienaar has done is that he's created an event, but that event is lost. And for me, that's what's interesting about, how I try to do my work. It's not that we forget about the event, though that's entirely possible and does happen. We can't really forget, say, again, 1917, or if you're South Africa, 1976, or, I'm sure they are, or the 4th of July, or something like that. But what really sort of piques my interest consistently are those moments that are not recognized as an event, and they have to be almost recovered. They have to be put back together so as to understand everything that accretes to that moment. And so what I really enjoy doing is sort of recognizing that moment, of course, almost always in retrospect, and then trying to make a philosophical case, as it were, for why this constitutes an event, which is in itself important. But what is equally significant is the way in which, through thinking the event, it's possible to understand how the event comes to be, you know, the conditions that have made this event possible. So what leads up to this, what's ignored, what's forgotten, what's overlooked. Those are the things that I try to give some philosophical visibility and, if possible, some philosophical heft to. And the Mandela moment is wonderful because, you know, everybody's so euphoric. And they're like, oh my goodness, we won the Rugby World Cup and Pinar and Mandela. And nobody talks about that moment of negation.
Yeah, I found that chapter I'm an historian by training, so I found that chapter particularly interesting. I think you do a great job of pointing out the love and the suffering that both Pinar and Mandela have to bring to that moment in order for it to become an event. How it becomes this moment of both of reconciliation as we remember it now, but at the moment itself, I think you're right, totally a moment of conciliation. One of the things that was most interesting for me, though, is that events have a kind of bidirectionality. For me, that idea was very interesting. I was wondering if you could unpack a little bit what that was and why that's so essential to thinking about something as an event in particular.
Well, you know, Kierkegaard says somewhere, the decision changes everything. And that's how I think of the event. In this case, and you're right to highlight the term reconciliation, because that's precisely what I'm arguing against. The burden of overrepresentation had an earlier, shall we say, name or conceptualization, and that conceptualization was conciliation. And I think I would have, you know, as a title, it might have been strange, because I don't think we distinguish between conciling and reconciling. I think we understand both of them to bring opposing parties together. Where there was enmity and antagonism, there's now a sort of workable solution. There's harmony. There's, you know, through mediation, a kind of compromise or negotiation is being achieved. And what I try to extract, if that's the right word, or excavate or make philosophically visible in all three of the chapters of The Burden of Overrepresentation is this sense that, you know, one, we're not prepared for the event, and two, when it happens, we don't have a language for it. But in this book, in The Burden of Overrepresentation, I am committed to thinking the event through conciliation, which is to say, conciliation can only be thought through a kind of refusal of reconciliation. It is not to bring things together, but conciliation, I argue in The Burden of Representation, Overrepresentation, is the first sort of ethical moment in politics, because it refuses any neat suture, any coming together, any kind of reconciliation. And I think what I try to do, especially in the Mandela and the Pinar chapter, is posit Mandela as being on the wrong side of history. There are other reasons, and I've made this case in other contexts, for why I disagree with Mandela, but yeah, it's striking that it's the white Afrikaner who comes from a conservative, you know, lower middle class background, who gets it, who gets that you can't have reconciliation here. You must have something else. You must have a moment of conflict. You must have a political refusal. And it's Pinar who offers that. It's not Mandela. And that's what's striking to me. This is what the event does. It completely upends and overturns political expectation. Things are not what they seem to be, as it were. And so that's why I attach such importance to the notion of conciliation. And it's a thread that, you know, runs through all three chapters of this book. But the refusal to bring things together neatly, the rejection of suturing, and instead an insistence upon this moment, the first moment of conflict, the first moment of coming into contact with something that resists. And often, and quite, I would have to say, joyfully, it's Pinar who gives me that, you know. So, I know there's a terrible 80s song that says, looking for love in all the wrong places, looking for love in too many spaces, you know, but I like the
idea. I know the song.
Yeah, I like the idea of sort of looking for, or rather being confronted by something that comes from an unexpected source. You know, the event originates, if that is really such a term. It begins somewhere other than where you think it it will, and it lodges itself within some figure other than the expected character or narrative. It's somewhere else. And, you know, Pinar, you know, strikes me as an unlikely catalyst for the event, but all the more interesting, all the more philosophically revealing and rich.
I that makes me think about the chapter on Jackie Robinson, because it's a bit of a what's the word I want to use? It flips the script in some ways of what we've come to understand about Jackie Robinson in some meaningful ways. And for me, that chapter was great at explaining exactly how you thought about overrepresentation as a concept. So I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about Jackie Robinson and overrepresentation.
Well, you know, I have, when I was finishing up The Burden of Overrepresentation and talking with my editor and going through copy edits and that kind of thing, I was, you know, for some reason, I knew that I had used this concept before. And, you know, something that I was in grad school, one of my best friends, David Allison, lives in Sydney. You know, so I hope he gets to hear this. I'm not sure he wants to, but I had been, this concept had sort of come to me, if that's the right phrase, and or the right explanation of how things came to be. And I'd written this very small essay in a journal called Social Text, and it was about they didn't name it, but the concept I'm working with there is the burden of overrepresentation. And then I publish What's My Name, and there it is again. And so, you know, I think it's Socrates or Plato. Certainly Heidegger says it in Was heißt denken, but they say, we only have one idea. All we do is keep repeating it. We don't know that, but we only have one idea. And initially, I think I was kind of offended by this because, you know, I think I'm like most folks in this profession. I imagine that I have more than one thing. In fact, I imagine I have quite a few things to say. To have that reduced and crucible, if there is such a verb, to one, I find slightly disconcerting. But in any case, this concept was lodged in me, as it were. And, you know, in my first articulation, well, this is, must be 94 and then 2003, what I offer is, a schematic outline, which is to say the exceptional individual from a marginalized community has to bear a burden that is excessive and undue, if you will, in relation to the individual, because the individual is always metonymic. The individual always stands as the exceptional figure. So the individual who figures as the burden of overrepresentation, Jackie Robinson, even Barack Obama, if you will, Althea Gibson, Serena Williams, I think, bucks the trend in a very interesting way. But you're not allowed to transgress. You know, so a figure like Ali can stand as a burden, as a figure for the burden of overrepresentation, but more likely it's a figure such as Jackie Robinson. And we always understand Robinson to have been, if not quiescent, if not always sort of accommodating, then certainly the kind of guy who wasn't going to rock the boat. And, you know, there's some grounds for that. Jackie Robinson was, after all, a Rockefeller Republican, right? When Rockefeller's going up against Kennedy, he has to meet with both of them, and he meets with Kennedy, and he asks him, you know, in what language I'm now roughly transcribing, about the Negro problem. And Kennedy, in his thick, Boston drawl, says, you know, Mr. Robinson, there aren't many Negroes in my state, so I don't really know anything about them. Robinson walks out, and he says to a friend of his, he says, you know, if you want to be president of America, then you better find out about this. And so he talks to Tricky Dicky Nixon. And Nixon, you know, who grew up in Yorba Linda, California, goes to Whittier College, Duke Law School. So, you know, a fairly sort of circumscribed, closed world. He has some ideas about, you know, what it means to think about race relations in the U.S. And Robinson, you know, votes for Nixon. And those... That's his litmus test, right? That's the currency of the realm that matters to Robinson. So, you know, there are always exceptional individuals within marginalized communities, and the burden they have to bear is disproportionate. And so, having said that, what I find remarkable, again, a very small moment that I get from reading Roger Kahn's The Boys of Summer, a moment when Jackie Robinson is playing... he's playing catch with his best friend on the team, Pee Wee Reese, who's also the Dodgers captain. You know, they're in New Orleans, and once they're in Florida, but this event, I think, takes place in Pelican Park, or Pelican Field, I think, in New Orleans. And Robinson's just playing catch. And because this is the South, and the Dodgers are barnstorming, and, you know, baseball's just been integrated. You know, the Negro section is insufficient to accommodate, all the potential Black patrons. And, you know, the police reluctantly open the white section, some part of the white section, to accommodate these people. And the Negroes cheer, you know. And Robinson says this, now imagine recently, this most un-Robinson thing. He says, stupid bastards, don't cheer, stupid bastards, you got it coming. And it's a wonderful moment because it's so out of public character, as it were, with what we understand Jackie Robinson to be, you know, the exemplary Negro, the guy who doesn't confound. And Robinson says, you know, like, don't cheer, you stupid bastards. You got it coming. These are your rights. And so for Robinson, this is offensive. But it's also, for me, incredibly revealing because it's so disjunctive, discontinuous with how Jackie Robinson is understood as a figure. And so the man who bears the burden of overrepresentation in such an exemplary fashion reveals himself through what I take to be an event.
Yeah, I was just fascinated with this particular case. I was thinking about how you were thinking about this curse of service and this framing of Robinson, that he must have really suffered and understood this what Ricketts had asked him to do. And then this moment of almost Fanonian, breaking of that, but interestingly targeted at people we wouldn't have expected. Like, he suffers all this misfortune, white America is, you know, the one punishing him, and then the bastards, who is he talking about? I think you unpack that idea of how many different audiences maybe that bastards has in fascinating ways.
Yeah, I think, you know, I would not use audiences. I think you're polite. I think they're targets, you know. And I think it's scattershot and universal. I think he's saying stupid bastards about African-Americans or Negroes, as the term would have been in that moment. He's really mad at them for cheering because he's like, it's your right. don't do this. It's your right, you know, because you demean yourself. And Robinson is a man of intense dignity, just at that kind of level, ontologically speaking. But he's also, you know, riled up by the police, because this kind of concession is clearly something they don't want to make. But he's also, Robinson, you know, he takes the promise of American democracy really, really seriously in that moment. He's like, no, the police should not be allowed to demean you in such a way that you cheer for something which is rightfully yours. And at the core, it's a legal discourse. You know, Robinson's saying, this is your right. And if you treat it as though it were an exception, then you become complicit in the system. And even though I think there are many targets, including Branch Rickey, including the Dodgers brass, right? These people who make so much money off him barnstorming. Jackie Robinson never made more than $40,000 in a season. That sounds paltry now. And it wasn't a bad salary then, but the Dodgers more than made that, you know, on a couple of weeks of barnstorming in the South. So Robinson was their cash cow. And Robinson's mad at them, but his main target, it's self-reflexive, but the question Robinson doesn't raise, or certainly not in front of Roger Kahn or Pee Wee Reese, is his own complicity in the system, right? I'm the guy they come in to watch. I'm the cash cow. You know, I'm not innocent here. And it's all those different layers. And
eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor's the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
There was a moral element kind of underpinning, a moral question, I should say, underpinning this whole chapter of representation and who over-representation and who bears responsibility for that. Who makes the immoral ask? I'm doing a terrible job of paraphrasing your much more poetic language there. But it was interesting for me to see these characters, all of whether it's Branch Rickey or even Robinson himself, all these people we hold up as sports heroes. They broke the color barrier in baseball, but actually maybe there was the breaking of the color barrier also relied on a certain kind of moral moral violation itself, to even ask Robinson to do that, to agree to be this symbol.
I think the line that Roger Kahn uses is, Rickey asks Robinson to encase his natural volatility in lead. That's the phrase. And it's a remarkable insight into what Robinson is asked to do. And so that is presumed to be a truth. But what is never really thought about, and I mean thinking in a Heideggerian sense, you know, where it is what we do, we never think about Robinson in that way. Or if we do, we gloss it and we say he did this or he did that. And I try to, as you know, historian that you are, I mean, recognize, I trace Robinson to, as to his roots, as it were, in the U.S. Army, where he refuses to go to the back of the bus, right? So we have We have all these figures in our head in 1955 and, you know, the Montgomery bus boycott and so on. But I'm saying Jackie Robinson did that. So there's actually a reason why Ricky asks him to encase his natural volatility in lead, because he knows Robinson is an exceptional man. And we know why Robinson was chosen, right? He was not quite college graduated, but certainly college educated. He'd been a four-letter sportsman at the University of California at Los Angeles. He was had been in the military. He was well-spoken, you know. And there was a lot of resentment against Robinson in the Negro Leagues, because once Robinson goes, the Negro Leagues pretty much, they get, you know, they get pillaged by Major League Baseball. And so something very important is lost. You know, I mean, it does mean that a whole bunch.
And that maybe he'd even gone out of turn.
Right.
Certainly Page.
That's right. And Page never forgives him for that. You know, Page thinks, but Page couldn't have borne the burden of overrepresentation. That's the thing, right? You know, Ricky didn't just want the ball player. He wanted a ball player who could deal with the stuff by not responding. So there's a kind of volatile passivity that is called for. I want you to be competitive, Jackie, but I don't want you to behave like a Negro.
In thinking about both these chapters together, the Pinar and the Robinson chapter, there's all these great linkages between all of your chapters, is that both are able, right? They can't have an event. This overrepresentative figure can't be that figure, except that they are able to be that figure, right? Not.
Yeah. And that's exactly it, right? It's Robinson and Pinar, and they're sort of historically perfectly situated, right? It's what history throws up, and it's what they have to it's both what they have to confront and the ways in which they're equipped to confront the stuff. Right there, you know, to use a sort of, you know, Kantian philosophy language, you know, like the world historical figure. I mean, Hegelian, right? World historical figures. That's what they are. And they're not just historic in that they break the mold, but that they represent they instantiate best what this moment, in all its complexity, difficulty, contradictions, that's what they do. And I think what motivates me in the Robinson chapter is wanting to undo all the stuff about how Robinson has come to be canonized. And I think that canonization is a pacification of Jackie Robinson. And what I tried to do was suggest that there's an event that reveals a kind of truth about Robinson that is lost because of canonization. The cost of canonization is the event. And what the burden of representation tries to do is to bring the event back and then to show how that is, in fact, entirely consistent with Jackie Robinson, and that the canonized pacifist Jackie Robinson, well, we should give it another look.
I want to turn to your last chapter so that we have time to go through this. And this is a chapter where you write about seeing Derrida in South Africa at the World Cup. I wonder if you can unpack that chapter a little bit for us, because that chapter in particular for me was interesting as a French historian by training, and certainly someone interested in the post-colonial and colonial relationships between France and its colonies in North Africa. So I wonder if you can talk to us a little bit about that chapter.
Well, let me start with a little bit of a story. All three of the books in the trilogy have three figures. Oh, at least they all have three chapters. Andre New has two figures who are identifiable, and a third one, which is more of a collectivity. But I started the burden of overrepresentation, as I said, imagining that the governing concept was going to be conciliation. And I wrote it as such, and then I've always, in fact, this has a very Sydney beginning, this chapter. I was in Sydney, I think, in 2009. My wife and our son was not yet a year then, and we were, in fact, I can tell you exactly the date. It was the 23rd of July, 2009, and it's my friend David Allison's birthday. And we had flown into Sydney and then gone up to Griffith University and come back down to Sydney. And my wife and I gave a couple of talks and at Griffith. Then we came back down to Sydney and, I was asked to give a lecture there. And I gave a lecture on Derrida as an African philosopher. And this is something I had been thinking about for a while, and particularly because of two Derridian works. One is Spectres of Marx, which is dedicated to Chris Harney, somewhat, I would say expediently, but no matter. And the other one is Monolingualism, a text that I really love. And this is all about Derrida trying to figure out, I have only one language, it is not my own. I have only one language, it is not my own. What is going on here? And I also knew that, from reading the biography, that Derrida was a keen footballer, not a very good one, but a keen one. Like Camus had been before him, another Pied Noir. And so that was actually driving me. So I give the talk in Sydney, and it's, fairly well received. And at that point, I'm sort of, writing other things and In Motion at Rest is more or less top of my priority. It's not as far at the top as it should be, but there it is. Derrida kind of haunts me as his proper from Spectres of Marx. And I write the chapter on Pinero. I write that first. I write the chapter on Robinson second. In the book, the order is reversed. But then I'm reading more and more Derrida, and I completely rewrite the book. It goes from being the project that I proposed to Temple University Press turns out to be almost nothing like the book that they eventually published. And that was a rather wonderful experience. But what it allowed me to do was to take up this issue of Derrida as an African philosopher, as a thinker of Africa. And I can do this in a kind of fantastical way. I can do exactly what Derrida does, which is, Inspectors of Marx, you can sort of say, a specter is haunting Europe. And my point of entry to this is that the philosopher born in Algiers is almost never recognized as an African philosopher, certainly not south of the Sahel. He's recognized as a French philosopher. And so it's quite, this is the case that I'm trying to make, is that, Derrida's own silence, the specter of Africa, the specter of Algiers, and Derrida says quite wonderfully in Monolingualism, it's not the Nazis who disenfranchised me, it's Vichy France. They must have had it in their heads all along. And I imagine I must have had something in my head all along, and that is, like, Derrida must be located as a thinker of Africa. Derrida must be understood in that way. And I use the imperative tone there because without that, something is lost. And so I read Derrida's oeuvre as much as one possibly can, and I'm trying to make the case for Derrida as an African philosopher, not an exclusively African philosopher, but a philosopher who is deeply rooted in the African experience and doesn't attend to that. So, the opening is very weird. Like it says, I think I saw Jacques Derrida at the 2010 World Cup in South Africa. And I give myself a fair amount of poetic license. So, you know, Derrida is, I wanted to write about Derrida as an African philosopher, but not in a conventional way. I wanted to come at this through something where I could thread Derrida into questions about race and post-coloniality and, you know, to echo his notion that it's not Vichy, it's not the Nazis who disenfranchise me. It's Vichy France. Again, the event begins with the unexpected party.
Yeah. I mean, as a Vichy historian, trade. In fact, he's 100% right as well.
Yeah, no, it's the decree of Crémieux, right? Yeah. 1840.
And of course, as we now know, the Vichy begins their anti-Jewish legislation before the Nazis are even prepared for it, and the Nazis have to kind of ask them to slow down.
Catch up.
We're not ready for you guys to do all the things we're going to ask you to do later.
Yeah, that's right.
But the final part of this chapter where you kind of integrate your thinking about Derrida, the kind of spectral nature of ideas and concepts that can float behind us and infiltrate our world and influence us in interesting ways. And the way you illustrate that through these Algerian footballers, these French Algerian footballers, I think is pretty evocative. So I was wondering if you could unpack how you came to that idea. And I think what's most interesting for me about this is then where you turn to the idea of the state itself being kind of spectral and not always as rigid or as concrete as a concept as we want to imagine it.
Yeah, I mean, that, you know, surprisingly, that did not take a great deal of, didn't take a great deal of work, because as somebody who has, you know, has intellectual roots in the post-colonial, this was not that big of a leap for me. But what is interesting is that I can come at the precarity of the state through football.
Yeah, from a completely different angle.
Right, and the ways in which these French footballers are sort of taken up into the Algerian, experience, and then made Algerian, and then they return to France. I mean, that's the kind of, it's transactional, right? These guys, Boudet-Bouz and company, they're not good enough to play for France, but they're all right for the Algerians. And what I find interesting is that the Algerians are not ticked off by this. You know, they think, okay, you know, this is kind of what happens when you have reverse migration. And this is a kind of remittance from France to Algeria. And this is true for several players, because if we, toward the end of May, I hung out with Patrick, two of the guys on the 98 French World
Patrick
Cup team. It's the guy from the guy who scores the two goals, the central defender. I can see his face now, Christian Carambo. Yeah. Christian Carambo is one, and the other one, oh my goodness, I apologize, but I was hanging out with them at a conference, and we're talking, and Carambo, I mean, the other guy, he does all the sans papier work. He only scores two goals in his international career, and they're both against Croatia in the semifinal. But anyway, he's the central defender, and the name will come to me. But
it's not Lilian Thuram.
Yeah, that's right. It's Lilian Thuram. Okay. And, Thuram, Carambo, and I, I apologize, Lilian.
No, I'm a French historian of sport. Yeah, should have come to me right away.
Yeah, no, je suis SIU, but anyway, and when we're talking, and, Thuram's politics is very obvious. Where he stands in relation to race and all this nasty stuff. And at the conference, Thuram says, "I became black at the age of 9. In other words, the moment that I arrive, in France, from Guadeloupe, I think it is. You know, like, that's the moment I become black. Until then, I just am. But Carambeau, who's a less likely figure in this regard, you know, we're talking, and he's from, I think he's from French Caledonia, this he's definitely, and he tells me about what's going on around the what had gone on around the referendum in 2015. He says the French packed the electorate with all these, French new arrivals, so that New Caledonian independence could be thwarted. And here you have something very strange going on, right? I mean, they're quite happy to have Christian Carambeau, articulate, smart, well-educated, right? I mean, his parents are greatly disappointed when at 16 decides to become a professional footballer. You know, his father's a teacher and, you know, I think comes from a line of teachers. And so this form of exchange and this economy of remittances, you know, it's truly Shakespearean, right? Because what happens is that you're haunted, right? A ghost, you know, something walks, something unearthly is going on. And of course, Derrida writes Spectres of Marx in that spirit. And I'm interested in exploring that spirit, perhaps even extending those possibilities of haunting to understanding how the erstwhile colonies are now culling talent, or surplus talent, I suppose, from the metropolis. Right? And it seems fair somehow, because as I say in The Burden of Overrepresentation, you know, the greatest African footballer is born in Marseille, right? It's Zizou.
Zizou, yeah.
It's Zizou. And he had never been to Algeria. And he's not, you know, he's not Algerian in a strict sense. He's a Berber, right? He's from the Barbary Coast. And, you know, people don't know this about Zidane, but you know, he has four kids, French wife, French Catholic wife, and they've all been baptized, and you know, he's known to go to mass with them, certainly when he was in Madrid. And so you have this guy who's represented as, you know, in 98, of course, he's a hero, right? 2006, he's a villain. And I talk about this in Motion at Rest, the coup de boule.
Yeah. So I was living in France when that happened.
So, you know, and there's that moment with the flak jacket and, you know, he's standing above.
The music video, coup de boule, coup de boule.
Yeah, it's crazy. And so that actually, I would have to say, that kind of economy of exchange and the logic of remittances and sort of claiming back, is that sort of presented itself to me as axiomatic.
We don't have too much time left, Grant, but I'd love to hear about the is this the top part of the bun or the bottom part of the bun, entre nous?
I don't know. I think it's I think in many ways it's the bottom, and here's why. Even though it comes last, this is the book that I think, at least, let me explain. It has two figures, and each have a chapter, and the two figures are, you know, a man I now think of as the second greatest player in the history of the game, Leo Messi. And, you know, I think the greatest player is Alfredo Di Stefano. So interestingly, I think two Argentines are the greatest players in the world. And then the second chapter is, you know, this is, of course, just to thwart any Brazilian ambition and to offend.
You might get some emails about that.
to offend Joga Bonito. I'm sorry, you know, if you want Pele, you're welcome to him. I'm going with Di Stefano. Just watch the 1960 match against Eintracht Frankfurt, and then you'll see my point. But then the second chapter is on Luis Suarez. So it's a sort of Southern Cone book. I deeply admire Messi, and it's also about the state because, you know, Messi is a man who is not loved in Argentina, respected but not loved, right? He can never bring the bacon home. And I talk about the ways in which he's, you know, torn between, you know, being a member of the nation state that is Argentina by birth and by depth of affiliation, I would say he's Catalan, right? And then, you know, Suarez, again, the event of the biting and all that stuff. But so what I'm talking about is the notion of being between, right? Between the world and me. What stands between the world and me? Is it the nation state? Is it my own conflicted affiliations? Well, with Suarez, is it love, you know? Particularly the love that Oscar Washington Tabarez, the coach of the Uruguayan national team, has for him. But in the middle, there's an interlude, and it's a tribute to a 1985 football team I played on in Cape Town. And this was, you know, during the days of apartheid, and with this quite amazing team. I mean, we only had 12 players, which is odd now, right? We had one substitute, and it was almost the same substitute every game. It's like an impact player, right?
Yeah.
And that's all we had. But I had long thought about ways to try and honor that team. And I finally found this way because I had these two chapters and I have a very kind of irreverent Heideggerian opening. You know, I say Martin Heidegger knows nothing about Mitzrayim, and he knows nothing about Mitzrayim being with because he never met Leo Messi. So, you know, it's a sort of tribute to Messi, and I come at it through Hegel and Jacques, Jean-Luc Nancy. But that interlude is in many ways both an attempt to just pay tribute to something like death, because that team, that club no longer exists. These people have all gone their own way. You know, it's 30 years, more than 30 years on. But it's the bottom of the bun. In other words, it's the base insofar as so much of my love for sport and my deep, you know, enthrallment and engagement and pathological relationship to it comes from that moment. Not necessarily from that moment, but it coalesces in that moment. And
it's, you know, that it's ghostly specter.
Yes, and also I say this in the acknowledgments that, you know, it's the last book I will write about sport. And I think it may have something to do with, one, the desire to do other stuff, but two, the feeling that I've recognized where it comes from, and I'm able to nod in the correct direction.
Well, I'll be looking forward to reading this book as well. I want to mention one more thing about your book, which is, as much fun as I had reading it for the philosophy, I think our listeners should know that it's also incredibly funny. There's a wry sense of humor throughout. There's one line in particular where you're talking about the Afrikaners trekking towards autoimmunity that just had me laughing. There's a lot of humor in your work as well.
Go ahead. I'm glad to hear that because, you know, Heidegger is probably, you know, the most important, together with Derrida, and formative thinker in my archive. And the Ljubljana Lacanians say about Heidegger, 900 tones and not a single joke. You know, not a single joke. So I'm not sure I try, but I do kind of want to have a little fun with this, and you know, I poking fun at people doesn't seem like entirely a bad idea, beginning with Heidegger.
Good, yeah. I encourage everyone to go out and read it. For those of you who are listening, we've been talking to Grant Farad. He is a professor. He teaches at Cornell University, and we've been talking here about his book, The Burden of Overrepresentation, Race, Sport, and Philosophy, out now from Temple University Press. Pick it up. You'll enjoy it, I promise. Thank you very much, Grant, for joining us.
Thank you very much for having me, Mr. Rathbone. Happy holidays to everybody.
Yes, happy holidays to you as well. You've been listening to New Books in Sports, a New Books podcast. My name is Keith Rathbone, coming to you from Macquarie University. Thank you very much for listening.